all be seated. Good morning. Our first case this morning is in the matter of the civil commitment of Michael Stringer. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. The respondent will have 15 minutes, and appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I guess my first question is, we only see one respondent today. Is this, who is not here? Is it the commissioner or the county?
The county is not here.
Great. Thank you. All right, then, counsel for the appellant, whenever you're ready, please.
Thank you, Michael Hager for Michael Stringer.
Thank you.
Michael Stringer asked me to put in an appeal on his behalf, and somewhat maybe out of desperation on his part, and you know, whatever could possibly make a difference in advancing him in treatment. And he's been in and out of treatment, been under commitment for, I believe it's 15 years now. And we just wanted to highlight, you know, the testimony of Dr. Comaritis, who is an independent, really an independent voice coming into this system without that much, I think, involvement previously, but having a long history. And getting a new look at who Mr. Stringer is. Mr. Stringer is quite an intelligent person. He's quite an amenable patient. In some parts of his treatment, a very enthusiastic and highly progressed patient, almost to the point of transition programming. He's been through several iterations of sex offender treatment now, as has been happening. And Dr. Comaritis, looking at him, saying, this is a person I would trust being out at CPS. He'd have enough supervision. He's intelligent. He really responds to good treatment, treatment that is meeting him at his own level. He's got a lot under his belt, sufficient enough to benefit by the programming of CPS.
It's sort of the subtext that he's never going to complete treatment unless he's given more opportunity to be in the community and have that kind of experience?
Yeah, and there's something we don't discuss at all. Nobody, it seems to be in the background, is treatment burnout. And when does that actually happen? And then fighting through that and coming back. I think it happened a while ago. It's happened to him two or three times, and he fights and comes back into it. And that's because he's a different person. I get to see how treatment works, and it does work. He went in as a kind of insolent young gang member. And, you know, he had this sense of privilege in his relationships to sexuality. And I've seen him transform to, you know, he has children. He had a wife. He is concerned basically about being the father of his children and getting work and being a productive member of society, because he actually has that in him. And he went over to the prison in order to make more money for his family. He wasn't offered treatment there, but he had a stellar record when he went to Stillwater Prison. Then coming back from Stillwater Prison, he's met with a lot of resistance to what his commitments are, which are really providing for his family, getting himself going. He has lupus. He's faced that, which is a very serious illness. And he now also has a kidney disease for which he receives dialysis 3 times a week. He's over at the hospital 3 times a week. They trust him to leave outside the fence. They trust him in the hospital. He's quite trustworthy. And he's somewhat hampered. He's certainly hampered by his medical condition, that he might be dangerous to somebody at CPS. I don't think that's really a concern when you look at his behavior and you look at how he is. I think the concern that Dr. Comaritis brought up was that when you're looking at risk assessments, and this is, they swear by risk assessments at MSOP, you've got the static factors. And yes, he had a record of inappropriate sex when he was younger in a couple of instances on dates. And that haunts him. So, and this is, but Dr. Camarita's comment really was, well, this haunts everybody. This whole risk assessment structure can be used to actually deny that there has been progress.
And didn't the commitment appeal panel recognize that testimony, and I think its findings of fact reflect that that was that particular witness's testimony, but that conflicting information was presented both in the SRB treatment report and the SVRA report that say, that are based on more than static factors.
Yeah, well, he has an antisocial personality disorder. He responds quite well to genuine treatment. He responded quite well early on, and he has in the past over the years. And as Dr. Camarita has pointed out, he has a thing about the injustice that goes on at MSOP, and he...
Well, and I understand that, and I understand these arguments were advanced to the panel, and what I'm trying to say is, given our standard of review and the least appearance that the panel weighed the respective testimony offered by Dr. Camaritas and offered by Dr. Jones and in the other reports said, yeah, we get the argument about always being, that the actuarial analysis is always dragged down by what's happened in the past, but there is other evidence here that suggests he's not ready for a transfer. Aren't you asking us to kind of reweigh those disputed facts?
Yeah, I'm making a very difficult argument, which has to do with credibility.
We appreciate your candor, Mr.
The,
I thought it was pretty hard, too. I mean, it's sort of like the factors are the factors. It's like, you know, in the sentencing guidelines, you know, one of them is the seriousness of the offense, the other is the criminal history. The criminal history is the criminal history, and, you know, often that can very well result in more, a higher degree of punishment, but, you know, that's the way it is. Just as the static behaviors for risk assessment, you know, they apply, but following up on Judge Berkman's point, you know, in looking at finding 14, you know, Dr. Jones did not have very good things to say about his progress in treatment. I mean, he does not meet the requirements for transfer. He has regressed in his previous treatment gains. Dr. Jones, she mentions the, you know, entrenched social attitudes, but then she goes on to say, you know, his treatment providers have yet to fully understand his needs because of his lack of transparency and inconsistency. And then she states, you know, his treatment needs are best addressed in his current highly secure treatment environment. He must continue to develop skills in intimacy, problem solving, cooperation with his treatment team before he is ready to transfer. So are you, I know you're focusing on the static measures, but based on that comment, I assume you're agreeing that the portions of the findings I've just read are indeed supported by the record.
I don't know about that. I mean, we contested that finding. I mean, he is a very high level participant, even given his dialysis treatments. There was one point, so this was a contested fact at the panel, highly contested, that, well, there was a period when he wasn't participating. Well, yes, he was in the hospital. I mean, he did have physical impediments to participating, and there was one quarter where his participation was low. But by and large, and I've been around him ever since he was committed, by and large, he had a very successful, I would say, successful until his personality disorder kicked in, run right up to almost transition treatment, and he gets the program. He gets what sex offender treatment is. He's even called upon from times to be the leader and help others. He has been through it. And what our point was, well, if it's truly a 32-month program, and he was in a 32-month program and progressed quite rapidly in that program where it was serious, if it's truly a 32-month program, he is an amenable patient. What's he doing there 14 years later? So we just think there's some credibility factors. I know we're not supposed to argue credibility to a court of appeals, but here we have a specialized court that's determining credibility, I think, with some blinders on. And they found Dr. Jones more credible than Dr. Comeritas, and I think it's just the opposite. I don't think that the program's credibility should be given so much leeway by the panel at this point. When you look at, it's been 14 years, and the program is not broken. Dr. Comeritas is saying, no, this program worked. This is a guy who should get moved along, just in talking with him and seeing what he's done and getting his level of knowledge and his transformation. So that's a difficult argument to argue credibility, but we think that was incorrectly decided. And we also argue that there is, within the panel, an opportunity to review what's the best location for a patient. And that's certainly something we've brought up as a constitutional issue, but it's also right there in the statute. What is the best adapted treatment to provide for release and without further supervision? And
Would you agree that the panel could have found, as they did, based on the evidence? I mean, you're talking credibility here, but we have to defer to the panel. So how do we overcome that?
Well, I made an argument that I thought that based on what Dr. Comeritas said, that he could have been credible as well. Now,
then we're still stuck with what the panel found.
But in the credibility argument, I'm just saying that I don't think that you can find the staff, the institution, to be credible now, 14 years later. There's something broken in their assessments, and they will come up with. He hasn't reoffended. He's not at risk to reoffend. He's not that kind of patient. He's actually quite, in terms of sex offending, he's quite rule abiding. He's not that kind of person. But
is that supported in the record?
Oh yeah, they do not have him bothering people sexually at all. That's not his game. His concerns are with the actual rules that are applied, that are constantly changed. And he's, from time to time, spoken up on, you know, this is the rule and you need to follow it, and they don't like that. Because he's so well adapted. After 14 years, he's been there much longer than the people who are supervising him. He's been through this. And it's just, Dr. Comeritas and I thought it's just time for somebody to recognize that he belongs in CPS and he'll be doing much better in CPS. He's being held back. And that's why we brought up the Youngberg case, that it becomes a concern when people are being held back. And they'll come up, I know the institution will come up with years and years in the future of more things that he needs to work on. But what I wrote was, until he's finally released, fully released, discharged, he's going to have things to work on. Then the question is, well, what's the best place for him to work on what he needs to work on? And I think the place where he is right now is not the best place. It's really counterproductive to keep him there. That's something that was brought up in Linehan a long time ago, 32-month program. There is a burnout factor. There is something. Give a person a chance if they're amenable and get them through to transition programming. that's just being held up. And at one time, he had that opportunity, and I think that's been foreclosed. There's a certain amount of resignation, and he's, you know, his health problems, I don't know how serious the lupus is going to be in terms of shortening his life, but he's highly motivated to do real treatment and transition programming. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hager. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Drew Bredesen, Assistant Attorney General representing the respondent, who is the Commissioner of Human Services. We're here today on appellant's challenge to the decision of the Judicial Appeal Panel, which denied Mr. Stringer's petition for transfer. At the hearing, appellant argued that the panel should credit Dr. Comeritis and grant the petition for transfer. Appellant's arguments at the hearing were targeted solely at asking the panel to credit Dr. Comeritis and not to credit the institutional experts and the evidence that was within the institution's exhibits. And at the Part 1 hearing, it was appellant's burden to establish by preponderance of evidence that transfer was appropriate based on the transfer factors that are set out in the statute. The panel did not credit Dr. Comeritis.
My concern about the panel is it seemed not to even wrestle with the real crux of Dr. Comeritis's opinion, which is that so long as you're looking at things in the past and they take on almost determinative consequence under the static factors, no one's ever going to get released. Other than making in findings of fact 14 and 15 broad statements about the credibility of the SVRA and the SRB reports, I find it hard to review the commitment appeal panel's decision because it doesn't flesh out that pivotal issue of the static risk factors at all. How can we review that?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the main issue on reviewing that is that is an issue that the panel reviewed for fact and credibility below. And in order for the panel to inform that decision, one of the opinions that they take in is Dr. Comeritis. But they also take in the opinions of the historical records, the various risk assessors who have come in contact with the file, the various folks at the institution who interact with these guys on a day-to-day basis.
And I appreciate that. And it's not your fault. I'm concerned about these findings. They seem very skinny to me. They recite testimony and evidence. They don't analyze on an individual basis what they find credible or not credible or any indication of how they came out on things. And that's what I'm struggling with in this case. I understand they get to decide the fact issues, but to some extent, don't they have to at least demonstrate to us that they considered the precise issues that were argued?
Yes, Your Honor, I think they do, and I think that the panel did that in this instance because the specific factors that are to be analyzed are the ones that are set out by statute. And I understand the court's concern with the fact that, you know, there are these static issues, but that is part and parcel of the panel's analysis. The examiner is looking at that, the experts at the institution are looking at that, and, you know, the fact that, as a matter of fact, there are several instances where people who have these long-term static issues then progress through the treatment and onto community preparation services. And I think, you know, the fact that this one didn't go that far, all that really shows is that there weren't sufficient credible facts supporting that position on behalf of Mr. Stringer, and instead the greater weight of the evidence, and I would argue, but by a vast majority, the weight of the evidence was in favor of keeping him where the treatment most serves him, and that is the Moose Lake facility.
How does a 32-month program turn into 14 years and still maintain credibility?
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that question. The 32-month expectation that keeps coming up from appellant's argument. It's based in the Linehan case, the 1996 Linehan case. The specific phrasing there was that according to the evidence introduced at Linehan's initial commitment hearing, each of the four phases will last approximately 8 months for model patients. Those who complete the program's therapy and education requirements, satisfy the program's goals, and behave consistent with program standards. And I think it's been admitted here today that his participation was not consistent. I think that it's pretty clear based on the records and the testimony below that he has not been satisfying the program standards and hasn't fully completed all the requirements. And that's here on appeal, not to mention the fact that that was the main crux of the hearing below, is whether or not he is making enough progress to proceed. Ultimately, the challenge here is that there never has been an actual timeline imposed upon the program, and I think that's a deliberate decision by the legislature and the courts of appeal in the state throughout the years. Ultimately, the challenge is that there isn't really an on-off switch or a timeline or a set marching check boxes that we can go through that will mark, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down on any individual person. It's a very deeply individualized analysis, the same as the fact that each of their individual issues are very individualized to themselves. They, you know, the things that they have done vary immensely from person to person. Ultimately, their treatment needs vary person to person as well. So ultimately, we can't really throw a timeline on it. It really does depend on the heavily upon the experts and the people who interact with these folks on a regular basis to say, you know, who is and who isn't at the point where they are have satisfactorily addressed those issues and are safe enough to progress to the next step.
So is the purpose of the program actually treatment or to keep people in the facility?
The purpose of the program is treatment. It's a treatment-based program. The issue with that is that it also serves the basis of treating people who have demonstrated risk to the public such that they should be committed in the first place. And in the midst of that program, while they retain that need to be committed, then they cannot really fully be immersed in society either. So there is a confinement portion of that, but it's subsidiary to treatment, and it really is, I would argue, separate from, but the treatment is the main focus of why they're in the treatment center.
It just seems as though the program is not very successful at the treatment. And is there an explanation for that?
Yeah, well, Your Honor, I understand that concern. And I think that what you can look at is the history of this program. And, you know, counsel today brings up the fact that times change and the things that the facility asks for are changing. The treatment programs change, the needs change. These are all very specific indications of the facility trying to do better. The facility, you know, I hesitate to get back into the factual record, but the fact of the matter is that the science of mental health has a long way to go in the world today, not to mention in, you know, individualized applications. The fact that the facility is working to get better indicates the fact that it's trying, and I think that satisfies the things that come up in the history of our appellate opinions in this state. The Bailey case that counsel keeps relying on talks about how that if a right to treatment applies, it's only to the extent where a person receives treatment minimally adequate to provide a reasonable opportunity to be cured or improve mental condition. The record here shows that Mr. Stringer, by his own statements, believes that he is improving through this treatment. We also can look at the Poole case, and the fact that people aren't getting better isn't necessarily a reason that people get discharged. And of course, the Karsgins litigation that's been going on for several years has addressed that point as well. where we keep coming back to is the fact that these are serious problems, and we have to take them seriously. We have to do our best to try and treat these people. If the problem isn't solved, that doesn't mean that the problem should just go be, you know, unleashed and all right, we give up. They go back out into society. I think the end result here is if a problem continues to exist, then we keep trying to fix it. And I think that, you know, the fact that there has been progress is an indication that it is working. It just hasn't gotten to this stage yet where he should be put in back out into society.
Can I ask a question? Do you suggest we read the commitment appeal panel's order and findings to suggest they did not find the court-appointed independent examiner credible?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that they discredited
But they only make express credibility findings about the institution's evidence and witnesses. Now, counsel Mr. Hager suggests that's sort of a problem because if you're always going to accept the institution's representatives as credible in light of conflicting credible evidence, then this whole supposed procedure for seeking transfer becomes kind of a joke.
Sure. I understand that concern. I don't see that being active in this particular case. I think when a court makes specific credibility determinations on competing opinions, all it's doing is saying that this is the opinion that we credit most. I don't think that the panel is saying in this case that, you know, we will never believe Dr. Comeritis. I think there are plenty of other cases where his opinions are, you know, believed, and, you know, those change, of course, from person to person. Ultimately, what we don't have in this case is the panel saying we're never going to believe anyone but the facility. And there are cases, and there was a case, I apologize, that escapes my memory, within the last couple months where the panel ordered a transfer without support from the examiner or the facility, and plenty of others where there was only support by the examiner, not the facility. I mean, the panel does go with they do weigh credibility and in all of these cases. I just don't think that this failure to grant Mr. Stringer's petition indicates in any way an overarching reluctance to ever support transfer. So, regarding the constitutional arguments, they're new on appeal. These were not things that were brought up below. They should not be considered here today. Even so, the law is not really does not support appellant's requests for this panel to insert it into the statutory factors. The panel's authority below is narrowly granted. It does not permit a ruling based outside the statutory factors. There is no textual basis in those factors in the statute for appellant's analysis, express or implied. None of the authority suggests that in a judicial appeal panel proceeding where a person is specifically requesting statutory relief in a special statutory proceeding, that these outside factors should be incorporated. And to the extent that those arguments are relevant, I think they're relevant to non-judicial appeal panel proceedings. I think perhaps in a habeas corpus case where the actual efficacy of treatment is being challenged more directly, or the commitment itself, those are better places for this. But ultimately, in a special statutory proceeding, the special statutorily created panel can only weigh those things that it has the authority to do. And here, it did. And the conclusion that it came to is that those factors, all five of them, weighed in favor of keeping Mr. Stringer where he is at Moose Lake. That's the place that is serving him best and will serve him best. And so, in short, today, that argument is new, and it's outside the scope of the panel's ability to review below. That argument also doesn't have any support in law, and there has been no establishment of an error in fact or law by the panel below today. So for these reasons, the commissioner respectfully requests that this court affirm the order dismissing appellant's petition for transfer. Unless the panel has any more questions, I will yield my time.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Hager, you'll have the last word, please.
Thank you. We did argue that we thought that periodic review, which is mentioned in light of constitutional standards in Blodgett, that when we talk about periodic review, we're talking about the commitment appeal panel. That's periodic. In terms of whether we're reinventing or inventing a whole new kind of wheel when we have MSOP, you know, sex offender treatment's been around in Minnesota for a long time. You can go back to a 1939 case for sex offender treatment. There was the sexual psychopathic statute, and now this is the sexually dangerous person statute. But people in Minnesota prisons have been treated highly successfully. The legislature has done statistics on treatment in prison. So when the Linehan court was told about the 32-month process, there was a lot of history behind that, because that is a prison process. And if the people at MSOP on the prison side, which was where Mr. Stringer was when he progressed quite rapidly, if the same MSOP administered the program on the civil side with the same kind of requisites, yeah, it would be a 32-month program. It's a program designed from the prison system, and the prison system has been highly successful. We don't think that the typical I don't know of anybody who's gotten through MSOP civil side in 32 months. I just anecdotally don't know of anything. So none of the committees on the civil side would be considered normal or a model. But if there is if there is somebody who's close to being a model, Stringer is one of them. There's many people who are models who make it through. And I think that's what we have to develop. At least the commitment appeal panel has to develop a way of looking carefully at who is somebody that should be brought through. And I think that's why we have periodic review, as I argued, is in a way antagonistic to staff inertia, that we're getting another set of eyes, and we got judicial review, and have them really look carefully and searchingly. And that's why we bring up that we still think the strict scrutiny standard, which was mentioned in Minnesota cases, that there should be a higher level of scrutiny in these cases, or at least more searching review in this periodic review that was mentioned in Blodgett. And Blodgett said, you know, that's what has it be constitutional, that there is periodic review. I think there has to be some real teeth in it. And this is a case where I think we drew the lines where it wasn't very, very searching what they looked at with Mr. Stringer. And I can see after 14 years you can build a record saying, well, this guy's just a failure. You could build that. But that's if you didn't really know him and what he's done and what kind of person he is. And I think Dr. Camaritas got that across, but it just didn't seem to hold any value, that this is a person who's really ready in an independent view. And that maybe the institutional view is not one that should be accepted in this case. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hager. The matter is submitted.